History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and take the time to patiently listen as memories from way back take on new life in the here and now. Our aim is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. When it comes to that generation that served in World War II, 99%, this is the actual published data, 99% of the more than 16 million Americans who served in the war are no longer with us. Those who remain are either at or approaching the century mark, and an amazing vet who I've had the privilege of calling a friend for about a decade now is celebrating his 100th birthday this weekend. In visiting with him this week and thinking back on his life story, I was struck by something I guess I probably get desensitized to through all these years of interviewing veterans. What he survived during World War II, what he's endured since, and the fact that he's still going with as sharp a memory as ever at age 100 is something that has the potential to provide hope for the rest of us as we face some of the trials and tribulations that come our way. If we can persevere any way close to the way the gentleman we're going to hear from today did and hold on to that hope regardless of circumstances, maybe we'll have some pretty good stories to tell someday too, whether we make it to 100 or not. Niall Smith joined the Army Air Corps during World War II. It would become the Air Force by the time he served in the Korean War and then the Vietnam War. All told, more than 22 years in uniform. But he was born November 6th, 1922. That 100-year milestone arrives this weekend. So let's find out how he feels about hitting the century mark.
I never thought I'd make it. I never thought I'd be 100. But I don't know why I'm here. Somebody decides that. I feel all right. I mean, most of the time.
And you still have a full head of hair, and you still have your driver's license. So what's your secret?
I got a new driver's license a while back. I don't know. Maybe it's like the doctor said. I've never been a drinker or anything like that. I guess there's a lot of luck with it. But like the doctor said, I haven't abused my body. I've taken care of it.
What keeps you going? What keeps your mind engaged?
I do crosswords quite a bit. I don't watch TV much. Football season coming on, so I'll be watching that. I don't care too much for basketball or baseball, but I like the football. I started watching that, I guess, in about 1966, or when that really got organized. You remember some of the Dallas team? Jethro Pugh, I remember that.
Yeah.
Bob Lilly, he wasn't that big. Of course, he was big compared to us, but he was only about 6'2", 6'3". Uh-huh. He was strong. Quarterbacks was, Troy Aikman was a quarterback.
Yeah. I think you're going back to Roger Staubach, too, right?
I think he was the best quarterback he ever had. He was a Navy man. He had finishes to her there, but I think he was the best, and he was very religious. Just like the coach, Tom Landry. I remember one game, well, I've seen some here, they were two touchdowns behind, and he came in. I mean, he was just getting started. By God, they won the game.
Are you still following the Cowboys?
Well, kind of.
We could keep talking football. We could talk cars. He enjoys occasionally taking out his red Mercedes with that driver's license that's now good till he's 105. But wait till you hear some of what he's lived through over this last century. We'll start out with his childhood near Decatur, Illinois.
There's a small town called La Place, Illinois. And I was raised on a farm. Me and my dad were a farmer.
What'd you guys grow?
Corn, soybeans, wheat, clover. For cows and everything.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
Six brothers, no sisters.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a lot of hands on the farm then.
Yeah. Of course, they're not all at the same time, but there's over three or four boys there to help do the farming and the work.
So it sounds like that occupied a lot of your time then growing up.
Yeah, it sure did. As far as the cows were concerned, or animals, you got to be there 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody has to be there. feed them and take care of them and all that.
So as you're going through high school and all that, were you dreaming of getting off the farm at some point and going somewhere else?
Not really. Well, yeah. I was going to go to college. I graduated from high school in 1940. And I had a scholarship to a college in Carthage, Illinois. But then the war came along, so that was that.
Yeah, you were you had just celebrated your 19th birthday about a month before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember where you were when you found out about that?
Yes. You never forget a thing like that. Well, we were in a lay place there in the farmhouse in a dining room. It was about, or when we heard about it, I think it was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I was sitting there listening to the radio. My dad was over in the corner in the rocking chair asleep, and the announcement came on. The Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor. All military personnel, if you're on leave or wherever you are, get back to your bases immediately. So I woke my dad up and told him, what? He couldn't believe it, see?
Did that hit you like a ton of bricks? Was that a pretty big deal?
Well, it's hard to believe. Mm-hmm. It was hard to believe, you know. So then I went into service in January of 42.
So you weren't waiting around to get drafted. You said, I want to do something?
Well, I didn't want to be in the Army, really, because, you know, they had a lot of time on the ground and everything. So either the Air Force or the Navy. So I enlisted in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm. How many of your brothers ended up serving in the war?
Okay, two others during the war. Altogether, there were five of us brothers that had been in the service.
Wow.
Four of us have retired from the service.
Not too many veterans I get to interview who served in both World War II and the Vietnam War, but that's the case for Niall. We're going to hear about that. And you mentioned the other brothers that were in World War II. Did they make it home as well?
Yeah, everybody made it home.
You had quite the odds to beat to make it home yourself. We're going to get to that. But let's talk about those early days in the Army Air Corps. Did you go in hoping that you could become a pilot? Because most guys that did something in the Army Air Corps say they wanted to be pilots.
Well, yeah, I wanted to be a pilot, but at that time you got to have education.
Mm-hmm.
I think now it's 4 years, but at that time it was 2 years. So I knew I couldn't be a pilot. So I said, well, I'll be a gunner or something like that, be on an air crew. At the time I applied, that was all filled up, so I couldn't get that. So I ended up being a mechanic. I went to mechanic school.
Mm-hmm. Little did you know what was ahead of you. Little did you know some of the adventures you would have, the close calls you would have. That it wasn't just medals you brought home from the war. You brought home something that's lasted a lot longer and been a lot more important to you. We'll get to that before we're done. But when you say a mechanic in the Army Air Corps, what did that mean you were responsible for, and how much responsibility did you feel?
Well, you went to aircraft mechanic school on a B-17. Of course, we didn't know what kind of planes we were going to be or working on or assigned to. Then, we found out it was going to be B-17s. There was about five men on a ground crew. There's always a crew chief, assistant crew chief, and then two or three other guys. You start out just ground crew, but I ended up being assistant crew chief. Of course, that takes several years to get up to that. But it's B-17s.
Mm-hmm.
And our group was formed, the 96 Bomb Group was formed in Walla Walla, Washington. And our commander at that time was Archie J. Olds. He was a colonel. He was later on, after the war and everything, he was in charge of 15th Air Force at March Air Force Base. He was a general, some kind of general.
And from going on the farm with your brothers to at these different bases with all these guys from all over the country, was that a bit of an eye-opener for you?
Oh, yeah. Started out in Walla Walla, Washington, was there a month. Rapid City, South Dakota for a month. Pocatello, Idaho for 2 months, I think. And then we got on a train and we went clear down around through California thing to Paoli, Texas. And that base was built, we just finished building it. And we were there about 3.5 months, and they were continuing the training to go overseas. We didn't know where we'd go, but ended up being England.
And I want to talk to you about getting over to England and about what you brought back from England. But the B-17, to be responsible for it operating the way it needs to, I mean, you've got men's lives in your hands every time that plane goes up, don't
you? That's right. Been some nights we worked all night to make sure it's right or, you know, get something done so that they could have the plane for the next day.
Was there part of that? When you go through all your checks and make sure this is operating right and this is moving right and that's running right, Was there one part of that that gave you the most trouble or that was the hardest to make sure it was doing what it was supposed to do?
Well, probably the hardest thing was getting there, like when you changed an engine. And then you've got to put all the accessories like carburetor and fuel pump and everything else on the new engine, transfer that over, and then hang the thing and get it adjusted to the right RPM and make sure that everything is working like it's supposed to work.
Because if it's not, that could cost some people their lives.
Well, that's right. That engine could quit or go out.
So was that fulfilling work for you?
Well, it was at the time. Sure. Just made sure you did the job right. I remember during the war, like in England, lots of nights we were working nighttime. We didn't have big floodlights and everything else. There's a war going on. We use flashlights. You hear a plane overhead, you turn the light out. Because they said that a plane from 10,000 feet can see a cigarette on the ground.
Wow. Sounds pretty tense.
Yeah, lots of night.
What about the journey over to England? Was that an adventure for you?
Oh, yeah. We got on the train at Pouty up through Fort Worth and Dallas. And at that time, the space between Dallas and Fort Worth, there might have been 20 miles or so. No people. But now it's all one big city. Anyway, then we went up to New York, and we left from Pier 50 on the Queen Elizabeth, the first Queen Elizabeth. And right beside where the Queen Elizabeth was, here was the Normandy lying on its side. Somebody had sabotaged it, and it burned.
That's encouraging.
So, yeah. So then we got on the ship, and it took us 6 days to go across. They changed course every 7 minutes, zigzag. And the only people that knew the course was the captain and the navigator. They did that because of the subs. 15,000, 18,000 troops on that one ship, 24 hours in the stateroom, 24 hours on deck. A stateroom that would normally have maybe two or three or four people, here's maybe 18 people assigned to that one room, about four high, you know. I know the first night I went out, had to go out on deck, it started raining. So what do you do then? You pick up all your stuff and go and get out of the lounge someplace.
Do you remember what it felt like emotionally? I mean, were you concerned that you might not see America again?
Well, not really. Young people, they're full of energy and they don't think about things like that. They just want to get in the middle of everything and they don't think about dying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't think about it until it actually happens or, you know, something happens and you think you might.
And before you went over there, did you think that your job was going to be a pretty safe job, comparatively speaking?
Well, but England was getting bombed too, see?
Mm-hmm.
And the first night we were in England, our base got bombed.
Wow. Welcome to the war.
And we didn't have any shelters or anything else. When anything set up as a new base, see, here was guys diving through hedges to be in a ditch, get in a ditch, stuff like that.
Where'd you go?
I just found a low spot and got in it. But there wasn't anybody killed or anything.
But it got your attention.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And how old were you?
Well, I'd be 20, I guess, 19 or 20.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
So then your bombers start flying their missions. And tell us what your duty was like those first few weeks and months that you were over there.
Well, we had to get them ready. If they came back, either bomb damage or engine out, something like that, we'd change an engine overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And that would take maybe 6-8 hours. And we heard that the Germans could change an engine in 15 minutes. They had all quick disconnects and everything else. Mm-hmm. We didn't. We had hoses and clamps and, you know, all kind of stuff. Anyway, you just keep them ready, and they always called. They said they need so many planes. We got to have so many planes. So there's lots of times we worked all night, you know, to get one ready. Even changing outer wing panels and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. How did the pilots and the crews of those bombers treat you?
They treated us good, and they depended on us too. Like the original pilots that we took over there, I mean, they knew what was going on, and they knew that, or they depended on us, and they got to know the ground crew and all that, because you can't have a plane, something happening on the flight. So, yeah, they appreciated it.
And you mentioned having to fix damaged engines or patch up damaged planes. Was that a pretty frequent occurrence? I mean, was it rare for a group of bombers to come back unscathed?
It was rare for them to, very rare for them to come back unscathed until about, it had to be in 44 before the P-51s got over there to where they could go all the way on the mission.
With as escort, yeah.
Right, as escort. Up to that time, they can only go halfway, like a P-47, they go halfway and they have to turn around. Then you're at the mercy, and here's a German fighter sitting out there waiting, see? So when they came back, there was holes. Of course, you had sheet metal men, that was their job. There was holes, there was half a tail shot off, you know, and stuff like that. So there was lots of damage, and we knew that that's how it would be. It would fly almost.
Did you ever look at a plane and say, I don't know how that one made it back?
Yeah, yeah. We had one, it wasn't our plane, let's see. Part of the tail was gone, two engines were out, the third one was going out. So actually he only had about one engine, one and a half engine. And he made it back, and when it landed, the gear gave out and he just slid, you know. They said if it hadn't been for the pilots, they wouldn't have made it.
It's time for our first break, but wait until you hear what Niall Smith survived and the lives he saved in the process during a nightmare scenario in the air over England that even at age 100, he remembers as vividly as ever. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and video with Niall, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma, because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there, and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a chance to wish a happy 100th birthday to Niall Smith, who gave more than 22 of those 100 years to the U.S. Air Force, starting way back in World War II when it was still the Army Air Corps. Stationed in Snetterton, England with the 96th Bomb Group, he was an assistant crew chief for a B-17 bomber in the 413th Squadron, and he described for us some of the conditions those planes would come back in. There were also times where bomber crews didn't come back at all.
Oh, yeah, well, you thought about it and everything like that, but you didn't really have time to grieve or anything else, because here you got a new crew and you got to keep them going, you know. So you just keep on doing your job.
And how often did your job mean actually going in an airplane and flying with these guys?
We weren't part of the air crew, but I did go on a couple of missions just to see how they were. You know how young guys are. One was a food mission when they dropped moved to the Dutch, and the other was an actual mission. But we made it back. I mean, I don't know why I did that. When I think about that now, I was stupid, you know, when I didn't have to go.
Where were you during the mission? What part of the plane did
I was, you? I was back in the waist.
Uh-huh.
Back in the waist where the waist gunners are, yeah.
Did you see some exciting action?
Oh, yeah. You see them out there just like Memphis Belle, you know, or same kind of deal. And you see things happening. I mean, planes going down, everything else. Yeah.
And in April of 1944 came an incident that I don't see how you couldn't say it changed your life. It's the reason you have the Purple Heart. It's the reason you have that Soldier's Medal I mentioned, and I'll read the citation about that in a little bit. But tell me how that all came to be, because you weren't initially supposed to be on that plane, right?
No, it was another crew, and I don't know what the other ground man or on the other crew, what reason he couldn't go for some reason, and he asked for somebody to volunteer, so I volunteered.
Don't you know you're never supposed to volunteer in the service?
Well, yeah.
That's what everybody tells me anyway.
But
what do you think possessed you to volunteer?
Well, I knew this other guy pretty well. He's kind of a buddy, you know, and just doing it for him.
And what were you supposed to do?
Well, the two ground men went with the plane the night before. See, our squadron was all what they call pathfinders. They took the ball turret out of the bottom and put a radar dome in there, and then they led other missions because they could bomb through the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to furnish planes to other groups to lead the other groups. And two ground men always had to go with the crew in the plane to the other base, and then we'd see the plane off the next morning.
So they needed you there because you knew these specific custom planes with the radar domes, and then you would have to check them out and make sure they were flight worthy before other group would take it up?
As far as the plane, yeah.
Uh-huh, okay.
Yeah, see the plane off.
Yep.
And then we'd get a ride back to our base somehow.
So how long of a journey was this from your base to this other base?
Oh, about 30-40 minutes.
30-40 minutes, nighttime?
Yeah, nighttime.
No big deal.
It's close to midnight. It's right at midnight.
And did you know the Germans had night fighters?
Oh, yeah. We used to go outside, at nighttime, watch the searchlights. And I know this one night, here's a whole bunch of searchlights that had, they were on this one plane. And all at once the lights went out, and then right behind where that plane was, here's a bunch of tracer bullets. So they set up for a British fighter to get on. Yeah, every night we'd see that. Every night.
So you knew there was a chance this could be, even though it's a short flight, that this could be dangerous.
Yeah, but we never really thought about it, mm-hmm. You know, just going to the other base. That was at a low altitude, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But this other base was right on the coast, and this German, he must have been out there off the coast waiting for somebody to come around on the pattern, and then he followed us around.
Yeah, so tell me how you experienced it.
Okay, we was on the final approach, and under the pilot, he'd turn on the landing lights, put the flaps down, and we were slowing down, and we were maybe a couple hundred feet off the ground, and all at once I hear firing, or hear bullets, you know, and I thought the British were shooting at us from the ground with anti-aircraft fire that maybe are little instrument they call the indicator friend or foe wasn't working. And then I looked out the side window and I saw the tracers going by. Every fifth bullet is a tracer. And I knew what it was then. I said, oh God, you know. And I burrowed. There was a bunch of baggage back there in the waist. I was in the waist. I burrowed my way down to the bottom of that, and that's probably what saved me.
So you knew as soon as you saw those tracers that guys were going to get hit and this wasn't going to be a smooth landing.
Right. I knew we were going down, yeah.
Wow.
And the man beside me, the bombardier, he was back there asleep. I mean, missing just to another base in England, see, and he stood up, what's going on? And then a bullet hit him, see. And I got a little piece of it, but...
Where'd it get you?
In the hip. A piece of it got me in the hip. And then it was hit because I could feel it. I could feel the blood going down my leg.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you get shot with a bullet, it doesn't hurt. It's hot.
Mm-hmm.
It's hot. That piece of metal is hot.
I want to get, and I know you're going to give us a great description of this, but I'm just thinking everybody listening has never been in this circumstance. Maybe we have a few veterans who got shot down, but even that's a little different. I mean, you're coming in for a landing, not expecting this, and all of a sudden this chaotic scene ensues. So was this something that it felt like slow motion?
Yeah.
Did you have things come to mind that you didn't expect to come to mind? What was that like for you?
Well, you've heard that when you're... Well, I thought this was it, see. You're facing death. I think, well, like, tell yourself, this is it. And your whole life flashes in front of you. You've heard that. That happens.
Literally.
It happens because things came to my mind when I was a little kid that I hadn't even thought about. And then the crash, you know, but it happened.
And were there other people trying to duck for cover, screaming? Did they not have time? I mean, did you hear anything on the intercom?
No, there was nothing on the intercom. There wasn't a sound in that plane. Everybody knew what was going to happen. Of course, it was dark. I couldn't see what the people up front were doing or anything else. There wasn't time to really do anything because we hit this row of trees, and all I remember is hitting the ground and this crash or sliding or whatever, and for several minutes, I guess, and then everything stopped, you know, and so, I was still alive.
So you're conscious this whole time?
Oh, yeah. Well, I might have been knocked out for maybe an instant or so. When everything stopped, why, I looked around for the back door, and it wasn't there. No back door.
And before it stopped, are you bracing? You clenching your teeth? You saying a prayer? What are you doing?
Just waiting. I was just waiting for, you know, what was going to happen, or wondering what's going to happen.
And you believe that the plane just slid along the ground, and I just showed you an eyewitness account from that I found on the internet where people say the plane actually cartwheeled, went end over end. With what you remember, does it seem like maybe that could have happened?
I wasn't aware of that, but it might have happened.
Because you can't see anything. No, you're just feeling
it
chaos,
was dark,
right?
Right. Yeah. And the plane broke in two.
Mm-hmm.
So that could very well have happened. That was news to me.
So when the plane stops, you look for the back door. It's not there.
That's right.
What happens next?
I turned around, and it broke in two. So I crawled out through a bunch of wreckage, the part that was open where it broke in two. And I got outside, back to the tail, and here's the other ground man, this Sergeant Matthews. He was laying there moaning, groaning. He was talking about some girl down in London, I think. And I didn't know that. I heard later that he had a broken back. I don't know if he did or not. But I saw all the flesh from his thumb. His thumb was clear back against his wrist.
Mm.
So I took hold of his parachute harness, and I dragged him. He was bigger than me. I dragged him maybe 150 feet, got behind the brick wall, and then I went back to the plane. There was two or three other guys there, and we got
the plane's burning at this point?
Oh, yeah, it was burning more all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it was going to blow up. I knew that because I'd seen him blow up, you know.
Sure. So you grabbed some more guys.
Yeah, we got the pilot out. The pilot was clear back in the waist. The co-pilot, he said he went through the top. And when he came to, he had a bump on his head, and he was hanging in a tree, still strapped in his seat.
Talk about a sight you don't expect to see.
Yeah. The engineer on the plane, he was trapped down in the wreckage someplace, and he had to take his pants off to get out. He had a finger cut off. He got out. The radio man, we never did find him. We couldn't find him. Of course, the bombardier was shot, and the navigator, we found him, or he said he was in the wheel well behind number two engine up in there somewhere. But we got everybody out, and we got him behind this brick wall, and this maybe took 15, 20 minutes or so. And, of course, the plane's burning more all the time, and we were just waiting to see. There wasn't anything else we could do, and all at once that thing exploded. And we had 1,700 gallons of octane fuel.
Yeah, because this, was a short flight, but a fully loaded plane fuel-wise.
Yeah.
Ooh.
We had four 500-pound bombs on it, two smoke bombs for the radar part of it the next day, and about 20,000 rounds of 50-caliber ammunition on there. And, of course, when it blew up, everything went up in the air, everything, maybe 100 feet, 150 feet, and the gasoline was burning, and it arched over, and I thought it was going to fall on us, and I got up and started to run again, but it burned out before it got to the ground.
Mm.
So it must have been half an hour. Of course, this was off the edge of the base, see. We didn't make the runway. About a half an hour, here come an officer from the tower in a Jeep. He was in Jeep, and the first thing he asked, He said, "Where's the parachute harnesses?" Because the gunners or the flight crew, they carried a little medical kit strapped to their parachute harness. It had morphine and everything in it. So he started giving morphine to the people that were injured, or you know. And I never even thought about that, you know. But then it must have been another hour or so before any ambulances ever got out there. And three or four ambulances come out, and they took us into, wasn't a hospital, it was just a dispensary. And they didn't do anything to us that night. I guess they looked us over and everything and washed your face and hands and stuff like that. And I'd lost my favorite cap. But anyway.
Burned up in the plane?
I don't know what happened, but it came off somewhere.
And when you said you never found the navigator, is your guess that his body was burned in that explosion and fire?
No, the radio operator.
Oh, I mean the radio operator.
Yeah.
You think?
Well, he was down in the wreckage someplace.
Yeah.
We couldn't find him.
But so then when the explosion happened,
he'd go up. And the next day they took us up to a general hospital, and I was there 2 weeks and went back to base.
How much pain were you in?
I wasn't in any pain then. I was bruised and everything all over, and I still got a little piece of that bullet back there in my hip yet. I didn't know that was there until a few years ago when I had an x-ray from my back. The doctor says, "Hey, you got a piece of metal in your hip back there." I didn't know that.
It's been there a while.
Yeah. Anyway, the pilot called me, had me come up to his, where he was in the hospital there, and he thanked me for saving his life. Hmm. Because he'd come through the back from the cockpit, back through the bomb bay, through the radio room, and he was back in the waist, and we took him out. Yeah. He said that was his first night landing in a B-17.
Wow.
And get shot down.
And you said 2 weeks later you're back on the base. A lot of those guys were wounded to the point that they got sent home, but you had to keep on serving over there.
Yeah, I had to stay. And I went down to the base hospital to see the doctor because I thought, well, maybe I can get back to the States. And I started telling him how I was having these bad dreams and everything else about it, and I couldn't do my work, you know, and that kind of stuff. And he looked at me and he said, "Nothing wrong with you. Get back to work."
Hmm.
So that didn't work.
Well, maybe it's a good thing because had you met a special young lady named Phyllis yet?
No, I hadn't met her yet.
Well?
But you know, after I was back to the base, they made me, after a week or so, they made me get in another plane and go up. They said, if you don't, you won't want to fly again. You don't want to get in any airplane. So I didn't. And after that, it was all right. But it didn't bother me anymore.
So we hear all this now about PTSD. And basically, that was their approach to dealing with your post-traumatic stress and these flashbacks you were having.
Yeah.
Wow. But it worked for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he is still going strong as he celebrates birthday number 100 this weekend. We'll have a few fresh reflections from Niall when we come back. Some of the people he's celebrating with this weekend wouldn't be here if he didn't survive that plane crash. And, of course, if he hadn't met his late wife, Phyllis, during the war in Scotland. We'll hear how that all came to be when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, honoring Niall Smith, who's celebrating his 100th birthday this weekend in Fresno, California. I promised we'd hear the story of how he met his wife during World War II.
About every 10 days on the base there, we get a two-day pass and go down to London, like two or three of us go together. And that's what we did all during the war. But then the V-2s started coming in, the rockets.
Yeah.
They go up about 50 miles, and then they come straight down. And there's no warning or
right.
anything else. I was in London. This was, I guess it would be about August or something. August, one of those rockets hit about a block away from where I was. I was on the sidewalk, and the concussion threw me back against a brick wall, and I was off the ground about a foot, and I couldn't move.
Holy moly.
And there was people out in the street there that it killed. So I said to myself, this is the last time I'm going to London. I'm going someplace else because I'm not dealing with these V-2s. So then I went up and started going to Scotland. They're going, you know, and that's how I met my wife.
Well, tell me the story. I mean, it's a lot to go through to have to meet your wife, you know, surviving this horrible plane crash when you're shot down and then almost getting killed by a V-2. And that's what it takes to send you her direction, huh?
I guess so.
How'd you meet her?
Well, about September of 44, I started going to Scotland. That's 400 miles from where the base was. And it's not like the train is now. The train doesn't, I think, in about 4 hours. But you had to ride all night on that train from England to Edinburgh. And if there's an air raid, they'd stop the train, pull mm-hmm. everything off. So it was all night journey up there. So I started going up there, and I went down to this, they call it the Palais de Danse. It was a big ballroom. And I saw her standing up there, and she was up on, I think, a balcony. And I kept looking at her, and I don't know if she was looking at me or not. Anyway, I went up and asked her to dance. And that's how we met.
You must have decided pretty quickly then that she was the one, because you guys got married while you were still over there. The war wasn't even over yet.
That's right. We got married in December. Yeah, it was quick. And we could only see each other every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Yeah, so much for a honeymoon, right?
Yeah, we didn't have much of a honeymoon. Yeah, we went back down to where the base was, and I think we were in Norwich one night.
So how much longer were you over there?
Well, I was over there until the war ended May the 8th, 45. There's a story about that, too.
Let's hear it.
Okay, the day before, I had a buddy that worked up in personnel, and he came down and saw me. He says, hey, the war is going to be over tomorrow. I'm married by then, see. If you want to pass and you want to get out of here, you get your pass and get out, because they're throwing a restriction on the base. Nobody gets on or off when the announcement is made. So I got my pass, and Phyllis and I were sitting in the theater in Edinburgh when Churchill came on the screen and announced the war was over.
Huh.
And here's all these other guys back at the base.
Was there a big cheer in the theater when that announcement was made?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I didn't tell anybody what I knew or anything, see, but I think people kind of knew it was going to happen.
Getting close.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was there any concern on your part that you might be sent to the Pacific?
I was supposed to be going to the Pacific.
What happened?
I had so many points. They had started a point system,
mm-hmm.
and because of, maybe my medal had something to do with it, but I had enough points that I'd get sent back early to the state. I didn't have the orders, but I was told that I was going to be assigned to the 20th bomb group or whatever it was, the B-29s in the Pacific, and to go out there. But I came back in August 45 and got a 30-day leave, and while I was on leave, while the war ended,
mm-hmm.
so I didn't have to go. So then I got out then.
Was that a pretty big relief to you to know that the world was no longer at war?
Yeah, I didn't have to go. Didn't have to go to the Pacific, because I didn't want to go to the Pacific. You'd go, but I didn't want to go.
Well, you had a wife to worry about now, too.
Yeah.
What was it like to be back home in America and to be introducing your war bride to all your family and friends?
It's something to start with, and then you just kind of get used to it. Everybody, you know, gets used to it. She didn't come right away, but she came in March of 46 before she came.
Uh-huh.
And she came on the Queen Mary, the first Queen Mary.
Uh-huh.
And here's, I don't know how many thousands of war brides up there. We stayed in New York for several months. I had an aunt in New York until we went to Illinois.
You know, so many people today don't know that much about World War II. It's so long ago now, and maybe people don't appreciate what the world was like or what it took to win that war. When you think about it, what gives you the most pride or the most satisfaction about what you did and all those other guys you knew did?
We did a job we had to do. I'd do it again, just like Vietnam. I didn't want to go to Vietnam because that was a war zone too. But I went, and here's all other people trying to get out of it. But I went, you do your duty, you know, you go.
What'd you do over there?
I was first sergeant. This was a transport squadron. We had the planes, and many carried supplies back and forth, and I was at Cameron Bay. The Viet Cong tried to get in there. One night, they almost got clear in. They had three perimeters of defense around every base, and on the last defense, they had their dogs out there, see, police dogs. And they got clear into almost inside the Viet Cong, I'm talking about, before they killed them. I wasn't in the fighting or anything, but the Marines and the Army were there. Another fellow and me, we were up there looking at some of the Viet Cong that they'd killed, and this guy beside us, hell, I know that guy. He's one of the barbers in the barber shop here.
Wow.
So...
That gets your attention. And was that any different for you, knowing that you had a wife and daughter back home while you were in Vietnam?
You think about it, but you don't worry about it. Something could happen. I mean, it could even happen on the way or on the way back or something, but or any place.
I've got a few more questions for you, and if there's anything I didn't touch on, I want to hear about it. But I'm just reflecting on that day in April of 1944 when this crash happens. And I guess the one thing, before I read your citation and ask you a couple other things, I'm just thinking about it, and I'm thinking of everyone at home listening, and they're saying, he wasn't supposed to be on this plane. He volunteers. He's on it. It almost claims his life. It did kill three others and severely wound all these other guys. He doesn't get to come home. He has to stay over there. If he doesn't, he's never going to meet his wife. His daughter's never going to be born. His three grandkids and five great-grandkids aren't going to be here.
Yeah.
It's a pretty incredible story. How do you make sense of all that? What do you credit for the way it all happened?
That's just the way the world is, I guess. Strange things happen all the time, or things happen you don't expect to happen, but that's the way it goes.
Is it something that you just say, well, that's luck, or do you think there was somebody up there pulling the strings for you, or what do you think?
I think there was that night. Yeah, yeah. It wasn't my time to go.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
You mentioned the pilot coming to you in the hospital and thanking you for saving his life. So there were all these other survivors. There were, what, I guess, nine survivors and three killed. Did you ever, after the war and all the years past, have any contact with any of those other guys?
No, I haven't. I haven't.
I wonder if any of the rest of them are still living.
I don't know.
Maybe we can find that out.
There's not too many left anymore, you know.
That's the reason we do this show. Exactly. So we can know these stories. And I'm so grateful for you sharing it. Let me read this. This is what the government said about Sergeant, at that time, Corporal Niall Smith of the Army Air Forces. For heroism not in action against the enemy, displayed at a bomber base in England, 12 April 1944, when the plane in which Sergeant Smith was flying crashed into a field, three crew members were killed and nine others, including Sergeant Smith, were injured. Despite his painful injuries and the imminent danger of the plane exploding, Sergeant Smith helped the co-pilot remove the pilot and other injured crew members. The plane blew up shortly afterwards. The bravery and utter disregard for personal safety displayed by Sergeant Smith on this occasion helped save the lives of the injured officers and men. His actions reflect the highest credit upon himself and the armed forces of the United States, and they awarded you the Soldier's Medal. Hearing that, thinking back to that, what does that mean to you, that they recognized what you did was something special?
Well, that means a lot. I mean, you know, it's just something that, you did your job and you did what you could. And I think most of the guys in the service were that way, too. Even ones, and you read stories about Afghanistan or Iraq, wherever, You have a bunch of buddies, you know, and you're all for each other. You're protecting each other.
Amen. And the one thing that jumped out at me as I read this, and I'm sure you don't pull this out every week and look at it, but the first sentence there, they say, for heroism, not in action against the enemy. Well, your mission wasn't against the enemy, but it was an enemy plane that
shot you
down.
That's right.
I wonder if they re-examined this, if they'd say something different. And I showed you, too, something else that I found. There's a record of the German pilot who shot you down, and he was the same age as you, 21, shot down 4 Allied planes within a 2-week span and then died in a mid-air collision about 2 weeks after he shot you guys down. What's that like, to know the other side and to hear about this man who almost ended your life?
That's something that's hard to believe. You know, if you had met him someplace or somebody you could have known, you know. I mean, he was doing his job. It's like you've heard stories about the two pilots, I don't know, it was American or British pilot and German pilot. They were going back from England to France, and they crossed each other or passed each other, and both of them were out of ammunition.
Right.
And they waved each other.
So there wasn't a whole lot of animosity on your part, necessarily.
No, he's doing his job. That's just like the flight crews. I mean, here you are, you're in a bomber, and you know that the bombs you're dropping, there's going to be civilians killed and everything else. And the flight crew, I've heard them talking. They say, well, that's just something we have to do. That's our job.
And the 3 men that died in the crash that could have claimed your life, did you know any of them at all, or were they complete strangers to you because you had just volunteered?
Well, they were all strangers to me because that was another crew.
Yeah.
I just volunteered to help this other crew, this guy or a buddy. I took his place. So I didn't actually know him.
And you mentioned right in the immediate aftermath how you did have some of those flashbacks and the dreams about it. Have you had any problems with that in all the years since?
No, not really, no.
Have you ever caught yourself thinking about it and saying, man, that could have been me? I could have
been
one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you think about it once in a while.
Where does that lead you?
Well, it doesn't lead me anywhere. I never expected to live this long, you know.
That interview aired on Hometown Heroes back in 2014, but as Niall celebrates birthday number 100 this weekend, his memories have not dimmed or dissipated one bit. You know, you've lived 100 years. You're in World War II and the Cold War and the Korean War and the Vietnam War. But how often does that one day still come to mind?
You never forget any details about that. Never. I've told you about it. But first, the two pilots thought it too. When the firing started, they thought the British were shooting at us from the ground. I guess they saw the tracers going by the window too.
When you think about it now, still today, what's the most amazing part of it, or the part that's still kind of hard to wrap your brain around?
Well, I'm still here because who survives a plane crash? And I knew it was going to crash. It's on fire then. Yeah. And we were on the final approach, see? Mm-hmm. He just called the tower. And we didn't have any lights on the plane until then. They flew down there without wing lights or anything. As soon as he called the tower, turned on the runway lights, that's when the fire started. Like, see the tracers going by the window, just like that. And there wasn't a sound from then on that plane, over, I screamed or hollered and everything. You just wait for it.
I know I've mentioned this to you before, but there was a little boy there that night who now is the Earl of Cranbrook and is in charge of that, you know, that estate there. If you were to go back there and visit that place and see the propeller they still have there as a memorial to the guys who died, what do you think you would say to that Earl of Cranbrook?
I'd say, well, I'm the last remaining person. I'm still don't know how I made it, you know. I'm still alive because when it did explode around me on the ground, we had 1,800 gallons of gasoline on that plane, 100 octane, and bombs, and everything went up in the air and was on fire and burning, and I thought it was going to land on us again, so I got up and I was going to run again, but it burned out before it got to us. But you never forget that. Never forget that night or details. And they finally got us in the base hospital there, and here come 2 nurses down the hall, and they were complaining like hell because they got them out of bed. I didn't think much of that. They were. and griping. The next day we went up to another general hospital. And that's where the pilot went through the roof, and the co-pilot did too. And he thanked me for it, because I pulled him away from the airplane too. But this other ground man, he went through the roof. He's bigger than I was, but I dragged him 100 feet or so behind that wall, just like I'd pull a box across the room or something, you know. Nothing to it. You have superhuman strength. You do.
Have you ever had any other situation in your life where you found that superhuman strength?
Not really, no. Not like that.
And how long were you in the Air Force?
22 years, 2 months, and 6 days. You never forget those dates.
And what would you say all that time in the Air Force meant to you? What did it do for you? What kind of difference did it make in your life?
Well, at the time we were doing it, I thought we were helping to save the U.S. But now all this stuff is going on now. I don't know what's going to happen to the U.S.
Words of concern there from 100-year-old Niall Smith that perhaps the rest of us can do something about. Just a reminder, you can find photos and video relating to Niall and his remarkable story at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Remember, this coming Friday, November 11th, is Veterans Day, so take some time to thank all the veterans in your life. And thanks for spending this hour with us today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.